This episode of Commons is brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. For 50% off your first box, visit HelloFresh.ca/commons and enter promo code COMMONS when you subscribe.
Crohn's and Colitis Canada is taking aim at a hurdle many Canadians with incontinence issues face, accessing washrooms on the go. They've launched the Go Here Washroom app and are asking businesses to sign on and open their washrooms to those in need. And they're calling on the Government of Canada to demonstrate leadership and legislate public washroom access in the Canadians with Disabilities Act. To show your support, sign their petition at action.crohnsandcolitis.ca.
Welcome to the second Commons Live show. Woo! And this is my first. And this is also our first show taped on the West Coast. What?
Welcome.
West Side? I always make the West Side sign whenever we say West Coast. I don't know if that's allowed. So you are going to get the full Canada Land experience. So basically what we're going to do here is exactly what we would do in the studio, just in a tiny room with like weird eggshell stuff on the wall. Are we ready to get this show on the road? I'm Hadia Rodrigue.
And I'm Sandy Garasino.
From Canada Land, this is Commons. So as you can see, I'm alone. My two co-hosts, normal co-hosts, are missing. So Ashley has accepted a wonderful new job that is top secret, so she can't be here, and we wish her well. And then Ryan is sick and was told he cannot fly. But never fear! I am joined by Sandy Garasino, a fellow former lawyer and current columnist for the National Observer. Welcome, Sandy.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited about this.
So today we're going to talk about fascism, racism, and how we fight it with our fists or our words. There have been a rise in flyers and posters around BC that are espousing anti-immigrant rhetoric and racist websites such as Stormfront, a prominent neo-Nazi group. And we're going to be talking with Annie Ohana and Garth Mullins, who are both involved in the fight against racism and oppression in BC in different ways.
There are 250,000 Canadians living with Crohn's or colitis, which are often hidden, debilitating diseases.
Crohn's and Colitis Canada have launched the Go Here Washroom app and are asking businesses to sign on and open their washrooms to those who are in need. And they are calling on the Government of Canada to demonstrate leadership and legislate public washroom access in the Canadians with Disabilities Act. To show your support, sign their petition at action.crohnsandcolitis.ca. So again, Crohn's is C-R-O-H-N-S. So again, this is really something that benefits everyone. Whenever we have disability measures, they go beyond just affecting those with a disability. They really benefit all Canadians. So now it's time for Is This a Thing?, where we bring news items and debate whether or not these are things we should care about, or things that we should just let slide in the news cycle of the day. So my first thing that I'm going to bring up is the OPSU strike. So for those who don't know, we have the teachers at colleges in Ontario who've been on strike for 5 weeks. And the opposing side, the colleges, sent a vote. They have this one-time option to send a vote directly to the membership. They were shut down. Overwhelmingly voted no by about 85%. And now the Liberal government is looking to table back-to-work legislation, something you are familiar with here in British Columbia. So Annie has thoughts. Annie is a teacher. Do you think this is a thing?
Absolutely, it's a thing. What the Liberal government's doing is harsh. It's unfair. It's in my mind unconstitutional, and it breaks any kind of collective agreement. The members have the right to, you know, the members of those unions have the right to speak out, and there should be a negotiated settlement. They should be brought to the table and discussions had. You know, unions are struggling. The BCTF just had a huge victory, so we should use that impetus to actually strengthen the unions across the country and not let governments get away with this kind of stuff.
Now, a question, if you have a stubborn college or stubborn mm-hmm. system of colleges that won't come to the table, mm-hmm. is this sort of intervention a way to get them to be at the table?
There'd have to be a real close reading of that legislation, right? Like what exactly are they saying? And unless it's, and I'm not saying, so again, I don't agree with the legislation at all, but there needs to be a clear delineation of what the steps are moving forward. And there are better ways to do it than something that's like zero or 100, right? Yeah. It seems like a zero-sum game where like there's a winner and there's a loser. Yeah. That's not what the situation should be here.
Well, I feel like Annie has just made it a thing. It's a thing now. It's a thing. Okay, so we've got the old orange monster criticizing Al Franken on Twitter. And some very suspicious radio silence on Ray Moore. So,
do you think it's a thing?
Well, I don't think it's a thing because this guy is just batshit crazy, and I expect him to just not do anything normal. So I'm like, of course he spoke out about Franken, ignoring the fact that he's basically a serial molester.
And he's going to do something tomorrow and the next day after that. And as long as he's just pushing buttons on his little phone instead of on the nuclear codes, then that's probably better. But I'm gonna say it's a thing, because I'm gonna say that he has now reignited the allegations against him, and suddenly around the world, media channels are playing the footage of the women complainants who had made accusations against him, and I think this is opening something up that was kind of tacitly agreed by the media, that we were just going to tiptoe around this thing and let Roy Moore do his thing and let Al Franken do his thing, and everybody was just going to be quiet about Donald Trump's history. But I think he has just reopened it with a vengeance, and now Franken isn't really the news anymore.
I know, but they voted him into office anyways. Well, so what's new?
But by that token, nothing that he does matters.
Well, yes. Like, the dude just has to be on another planet if he thought this was an appropriate thing to tweet. So I'm just like,
well, he does nothing that he tweets is appropriate. But it's just like, because this is the soft bigotry of low expectations, Sadia. This is like
Well, I guess we will agree to disagree on whether or not this is a thing. Garth, I believe you brought us a thing. So exciting.
I did. Yes. I always go somewhere with an extra couple of things, you know. And this time, Keurigs. That's the thing. You know, those little stupid coffee makers that you put a little pod and it makes one cup. Well, earlier this week, far right-wing white guys across America woke up a little more irritable, a little more angry, because they did not have coffee because they threw their coffee makers out of the window. And they videotaped it and put it on Twitter. And the reason they did this is because Keurig pulled their ads from Hannity, which is a Fox show, which was defending Judge Moore, who was getting reported to have assaulted, and worse, a series of women and girls quite young. And so they were making, I guess, a brave statement in defense of, fuck, you know? And I think it's kind of like, I think it's a thing, probably isn't a thing, but it's somehow like there's this beautiful, and this is a Vancouver take, is a beautiful kind of a collective nature of coffee. We have it together, we do it together, and it is so, it so epitomizes the far right kind of conservative mindset to take that thing and make it this single serving pod coffee automation robot. And they call us snowflakes. Let's call them single-serving pods in return, right? That's what I'm proposing. Maybe we could make this happen, like hashtag single-serving pod. I don't know. We could try.
They're also...
It's a podcast.
Oh.
The dad jokes are coming out already. I can't believe it.
Also, you already bought the machine. You dropping it out the window is not...
Right?
taking any money from, you're just going to have to buy another Keurig.
See, I just would encourage them to throw their computer out, and then we just wouldn't hear from them anymore. Right?
All right, so maybe this is not a thing?
I don't even know where we are anymore.
Yeah.
So
I think we need something maybe? Not to be a thing, and I'm going to make this not to be a thing because it's just idiocy.
Yeah.
Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks, short on time.
So I got a HelloFresh package. I got the package for two, even though I'm just one, so it's double the food. And I was amazed how long it lasted. So I was lazy and ordered takeout as well and didn't make my broccoli, my Brussels sprouts meal till a week later. Still good, still fresh. It's called HelloFresh for a reason. And then I participated in one of those meal trains for my pregnant friend where I had to bring her food. You guys familiar with these? And I forgot my slow cooker in my office, so I didn't have a meal for her. And I was like, I've got the soup. So I made the Caribbean confetti soup, brought it to my friend, said, oh, I made this soup for you from scratch, really played it up. She loved the soup. She actually texted me to say she and her mom were having the soup and loved the soup and wanted the recipe. And I really didn't want to tell her that I'd gotten it from a box, but I fessed up and told her about it. So she's also going to try HelloFresh. So I highly advise that you try HelloFresh. Make your friends happy, make yourself happy. And for 50% off your first box, you can visit HelloFresh.ca/commons and enter promo code commons when you subscribe. A quick question for all of you trailblazing freelancers just like me. If you could reclaim up to 192 hours a year of your precious time, would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, woo! Good, that was the right answer, because our friends at FreshBooks, who make ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software for freelancers, are the architects behind this question, and for good reason. By simplifying tasks like invoicing, tracking expenses, and getting paid online, FreshBooks has drastically reduced the time it takes for over 10 million people to deal with their paperwork.
And if that's not enough incentive, the FreshBooks platform has been rebuilt from the ground up. They've taken simplicity and speed to an entirely new level and added powerful new features. Oh, and if you're doing the math, 192 hours works out to 2 working days per month.
I use FreshBooks. In fact, I use FreshBooks to invoice Jesse for this show. And so if you're a freelancer listening to this and you're not using FreshBooks yet, now would be the time to try it. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to our listeners. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/commons and enter commons in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Public expressions and movements of hate are on the rise, and there's a need to counter these movements and organize against hate, but activists differ in their approaches to doing so. We are joined by Annie Ohana and Garth Mullins to give their perspective on these issues.
We're going to ask each of our guests to give us a bit of a background about themselves and tell us about your brand of activism. Annie, tell us how you got involved. Tell us about your history, your background, and what you've been doing.
I guess I had activism always in my life just because being someone who's a Sephardic Jew, who has family in the Middle East, being in that conflict. But then as I grew older, actually going to school in the United States and seeing the level of poverty there. And then coming back to Canada, where eventually I found myself as a public school teacher. Now, the BCTF is a social justice union. So at that point in becoming a teacher and getting involved very early in the union, very early in my career in the union movement, really starting to think a lot deeper about what social justice meant and about how we achieve those goals. So it came through my profession, it came through my personal life, and certainly in my public school teaching career, where half of it was on strike and really being bludgeoned by a government and put down. And then turning that around and going, okay, so I'm sick of doing that. I'm sick of being treated like that. How can I teach about it? How can I learn about it? And then how can I affect change?
And then you went on this last summer after the Charlottesville, the major events of the Charlottesville demonstrations, and of course the woman who was killed by mm-hmm. the white supremacist there, and you went on and were responding in response to an attempted hate rally. You mm-hmm. did something on your own. Tell us about what you saw and what you did.
As an anti-racism educator, as someone who, you know, tries to eat, breathe, and sleep social justice, a big part of that is the action piece. So, and this is not something new. It wasn't that Charlottesville was the first thing ever that happened, or that we hadn't those notions of doing something beforehand. But right after Charlottesville, a group of about like 7 to 10 people, kind of, seven to be the core, a couple teachers, but also other people in the community, just who were activists in their own right, came together. And within a week, we planned to hold what was a counter rally, and really to provide a platform for marginalized voices, and have their voice be the one that everybody hears, not the voice of hate.
And Garth Mullins, tell us, you have a slightly different approach. Tell us about your background and what your activism has been.
I've been an activist, anti-fascist activist, since I was a kid in this city, way back in the day, in the 90s. And in Ottawa, in the US, in the UK, because the far right is really capitalism and colonization's hooded fellow traveler. It just goes everywhere along with the system. It grows on the assumptions that are baked into the way that the economy and politics are run in this country and others. And so I've been involved in the trade union movement. A lot of my activism recently is around trying to be part of the response to the overdose crisis here in the downtown East Side. As like a white dude, I feel like a personal responsibility to go, you know, make smarten up some of the people that may share my skin color. And say the last big mobilization of the far right in Canada was in the 90s. That was the Heritage Front and a whole bunch of other groups like that out here in Toronto, in Ottawa, Montreal. And it kind of came along with the rise of the Reform Party. And, you know, we've seen another sort of pulse of far-right mobilization now with the rise of rebel media, with a very racist federal election campaign in 2015, of course, with everything that's happening in the U.S. But it's a global phenomenon, and Canada is really punching above its weight. We really contribute a great deal to far-right mobilization around the world. So activists here in Canada, we have to obviously educate, reach out, but also when fascists march in our neighborhoods, and they have, right down the street in front of this theater right now in the last 6 months in uniform. We have to stop them. Like, you think about the Soldiers of Odin who did street patrols here in the downtown East Side, right? And they're like trying to intimidate the most marginalized and vulnerable section of the city. You know, like this is the center of Canada's overdose crisis here. Mm-hmm. This is the epicenter of where there's going to be in BC probably 2,000 people dead of overdose. And it's not because of bad drugs, it's because of bad drug policy. And they're making that connection, right? So the idea of fascism is it doesn't always target the same people. It's got to scapegoat somebody, but it takes on different characteristics and different targets during different times and in different places. And so our coalitions, our opposition has to be as broad and inclusive. And so fascism really started out like before World War II, before the Spanish Civil War, as an anti-communist, anti-unionization effort. And Antifa was born on picket lines that were being attacked by fascists. And so whether people are being targeted as workers, as people with disabilities, as people who are drug users, as people of color, as immigrants, refugees, LGBTQ, that's the blueprint. The fascists are making the blueprint for our opposition. Our opposition has to be in defense of and composed of as the people who are being targeted by them. We have to have a vision also that looks past capitalism, that explains to the soft potential recruits of fascists that what you're seeing in the housing crisis or declining wages or precarious work or no benefits or whatever, that's not because of your target scapegoat group du jour. That's because capitalism is intended to operate that way. So until we are able to articulate from the left a really good, strong kind of anti-capitalist position, we're always leaving that sort of ideological room open for fascist recruitment. They can come in and say, oh, the reason you don't have housing or job or whatever is because of whatever group. We have to actually remove that terrain.
So for people who aren't from BC, It might be helpful to get some context on hate and racism in BC specifically. What does it look like? What has it looked like? And what does it look like now? Who is it directed against?
I mean, it's been here from the start, right? This is, you know, British Columbia. Both words sort of carry a lot of colonial baggage. But in this city right here, was founded on pogroms, really. There was an official white supremacy here by policy. You know, in 1907, a group of people went to hear speakers on the threat of Asian immigration in front of City Hall. They got riled up by the speakers. So this is, you know, just a free speech rally in front of City Hall in 1907 with all the most important people of the city. And this group of largely white folks then went to Chinatown and Japantown and went on a rampage. And, of course, people in Japantown stood up and stopped that. But this sort of thing has happened a lot throughout the city, throughout the city's history. There have been periodic, like, racist riots like that. The KKK had a headquarters here. So the idea of this being new is really false. And I think when we confront that, we have to realize that the resistance that we embody today is also part of a tradition which has involved every community around here. And, you know, so that means we got to build coalitions and take the leaderships from the people who are affected worst and first.
So recently there was a Prof at UVic who said that despite our history of racist groups in BC, that here in Canada, we lack some of the key ingredients from chronic unemployment to a history of slavery that makes other countries kind of a tinderbox for Nazi-style movements. So kind of that whole, you know, we're not as bad in Canada argument that you hear sometimes. Do you think that this is true?
I mean, I think the far right takes on a different character in every generation and every country. And even it's a little different out here than maybe it is in central Canada. But I don't think that we have different ingredients. We may not have the same ingredients, certainly have a lot of common ingredients as other countries. There is a mobilized far-right movement that's got the momentum right now, that's growing, and it's growing in a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime and maybe hasn't been seen for a few generations. And I believe it's not reached its high point yet. We aren't at the far-right high tide yet. And so that means I think it'll actually get worse before it gets better.
In my experience, a huge number of Canadians, including a lot of Canadians in the progressive stream, have never heard of rebel media. They don't know what it is, and they don't know what we're talking about.
Well, do your homework, progressives. You got to know your fucking enemy, you know? Seriously. If that means reading a little Breitbart and rebel media, then do it. You know, we actually have to know this. We can't just stick among ourselves. We have to see and not be surprised when this sort of stuff emerges. It's not like a hidden planet that's been behind the sun all this time and it just comes out. We shouldn't be surprised, you know?
I want to go back to something you said earlier, Garth. Is there something that's unique about Canadian white supremacy as compared to American white supremacy?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I think there's a particularly virulent sort of anti-Indigenous strain to Canadian white supremacy. I think on the coast here, it still continues to have a real anti-Asian flavor to it, too. They continue to trot out all the also regular, like, anti-Semitic myths and storylines and stuff, the same in the States. But I'm noticing there's a real globalization of the far right, that they're making connections and coalitions amongst all the different groups from Canada and the U.S. Like, rebel media has a huge amount of audience in the U.S., and they send their correspondent propagandist people all over the world. You know, I think the far right in Canada is still trying to find that sort of maple syrup politeness fascism sweet spot. You know, they're just kind of tuning a little bit. It's like, you know, and I think they still have to do that to find that place where it doesn't get offside with, like, you know, the middle Canada there, but is still palatable to the wide audience of the far right.
What I would say in terms of, look at the dates. I mean, we had Indigenous peoples not having the full right to vote until 1960, right? Mm-hmm. We had legislation on the books into the 80s and 90s about certain things. You know, South Asians that couldn't vote until 1947 or lost the right to vote and then gained it back. Any number of things that if you compare Canada to America, we are just as bad, right? Yes, again, there's differences, but really, we are no better. And I think one thing within the education realm is how much we sell this heroic nature of Canada, right? Oh, World War II, we came to the rescue, and World War I. And something I really like to point out is that counter-narrative of what was happening at home. And when you know, SS St. Louis is turned away, right? All the things that were happening in the residential schools, everything. That was happening at the same time.
Garth, you identify as Antifa, as I understand.
Yep. Yeah, I'm anti-fascist. That's what that's short for.
That's what it's short for. tell us about that.
Antifa is short for anti-fascist, and it's a label for a phenomenon that's been around for a century. Where there's fascism, people get attacked, and communities need to defend themselves. And that's what anti-fascism is. It's communities saying, we're not going to let people march on the streets. We're not going to let people use free speech even as a cover for organizing the assault and killing of other people. Because before you have the right to free speech, as Joe Strummer once said, you have the right not to be killed. And I think that's really primary, right? I am for free speech, by the way, just but I think that we have to not be fooled, just like in 1907 out front of City Hall when the Asian Exclusion Act in Asian Exclusion League in Vancouver was brewing up this mob to go and trash Japantown and Chinatown. That's what a fascist used free speech for, is a cover for organizing. So Antifa also, as a tactic, as an approach, tries to deny people that platform, to not be fooled by that trick. And if you go, and I don't recommend this, on 4chan and watch the discussions amongst people, that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, oh, the left and liberals are so easily confused by our use of the free speech cover. Let's just keep doing that, and they'll fight amongst themselves and get confused and maybe go home to their safe spaces or something, you know? And so we have to realize that this is a much tougher sort of challenge, but I don't see this as like a street conflict between two groups of people. You have to build a huge coalition of all the kinds of people who are affected, all the different constituencies, communities, and then you outnumber them 10-1, or in the case of the demonstration on August 19th, 1,000-1. And then you do deny their platform by just force of numbers. And that's the ultimate victory. It doesn't always get to be that way. In Charlottesville, Antifa defended churches and other places and people from imminent attack by fascists. And so when people say, oh, you know, there's trouble on both sides, whether really fascists and Antifa, they're both to blame. That's just so much bullshit. You know, and Trump started that, but then it really kind of caught fire in the mainstream kind of columns of the media landscape in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real misread. Antifa is a defensive reaction against a growing imminent fascist threat.
So Antifa has gotten a lot of mainstream attention because of highly publicized confrontations with white supremacists, you know, punch a Nazi. What does anti-fascism in Canada look like, and what role do physical tactics really play? How large a part of the strategy are they?
I think it's a small but necessary strike, just as a part of it. Just as like if you have a trade union, you only spend like 0.5% of your time ever on strike, but sometimes you have to do it to prove you're serious, you know? Sometimes that's what it comes to. It's kind of like it doesn't even matter. Whatever your form of protest is, it will never be right. It will never be genteel enough. If your form of protest is effective, people are going to hate it in the sort of mainstream columns of Canada anyway.
I think in a way, if it almost depends on your civil society. If you have a weakness in your civil society, then people are going to feel that they can't respond, that they can't really feel like the government or anybody else them is going to step up for them. So in the more extreme kind of physical actions, there is something to be said for thinking, well, why? Why did they choose that path? We have to use every tool in our toolbox. So if Antifa or anti-fascism is a toolbox, that physical kind of reaction, hopefully that's a very small minority, and it's something that, no, I don't think should be advocated for ever. But at the same time, what else can we do? I would never say that people who are in that movement necessarily want to be known as you know, the physical, extreme. I don't think that's a fair explanation of that movement at all.
So you have a hashtag in your Twitter account, which I went to, that says armed with peace.
Armed with love?
Armed with love? Armed with peace?
Yes.
Yeah, armed with love. Can you tell me more about what that means for you?
I was on a local radio station And they kind of surprised me, like, oh, can you take questions? And I was like, oh, okay. And this was like the 2 days before the rally, something like that. And this person comes on and he goes, what, are, you know, you're coming armed, aren't you? Like, just kind of goes full out about, like, what are you, like, definitely like the whole Antifa violence, right? You're going to be violent. And all I said was, no, actually, I'm not. And I got into a little bit of, you know, educator with like 30 seconds. And I go, no, I'm coming with something. I'm coming armed with love. I'm not the most genteel of people, so I definitely come armed with something, but probably not a weapon.
We were talking earlier. I went to the rally, and for Canadians who are listening who aren't in Vancouver, this was a phenomenally, incredibly successful rally. How many thousands attended?
Over 4,000.
It was very, very moving to be there. The day before, I'd been meeting with a Muslim girlfriend who was afraid to go because she was afraid that there was going to be physical confrontation. We both talked about this. We were both concerned that because of the things that had happened, that there was going to be violence and that it was going to be exploited by the racist movement to try and pigeonhole and label the anti-fascist movement as the aggressors and as violent. And I'm wondering if both of you would just talk about that perception and that worry that the public might have about engaging and participating in these because of the violence that's been happening. Where does that come from? And
comes from the Nazis. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes mm-hmm. from. Let me just quickly tell you about my own personal experience. I've never raised a hand or a weapon to anybody. So that's not my style. I support communities organizing for self-defense, but mostly I've been a writer. And maybe half a dozen times I've been assaulted for words that I've written by the far right. I have a couple scars, chin, forehead here from that experience. In Ottawa, they actually came to my apartment building with petrol bombs ready to burn the apartment, but they couldn't figure out which window was my window, you know? And so I was lucky, but I heard about this from someone who was there with them and then sort of like got cold feet and left the movement. And they're very serious about this. And they won't always take the fight to where you have 4,000 people. Mm-hmm. So I think that I really respect people who are feeling cautious about engaging. It is safe when you have 4,000 people come out. It is safe. When you have, you know, a group of people who are trying to train themselves to be peacekeepers or marshals or peace bearers or whatever to try and keep the crowd safe, that's part of Antifa's role too, is when you see a bunch of Nazis arrive, you try to push them out and keep the crowd safe. I think those are the things that we have to do. And in this town, one of the most high-profile events was the killing of Nirmal Singh Gill, who is a Sikh temple caretaker. And this happened in 1998. And four or five Nazi skinheads who were organized and part of a movement, part of a group, did this. And our response was that we organized with trade unions and churches and the communities in Surrey and the Sikh communities. And we brought together a big coalition of people. We organized. We took back the streets where this was happening. But we also had to protect ourselves because we knew they were organized too. And so that meant organizing a rally that was safe for people, but it also meant organizing a rally that could repel a force of people who wanted to do that. And, of course, the police and the local officials did treat us like a bit of a threat, but the rally had several thousand people. It was peaceful, and it was the same as August the 19th, because when we have the momentum and we build broadly, we can massively outnumber them because we will always be many, many more. We just have to organize ourselves right.
The day of the rally, if you compare it to the American example, in America it seemed the police in Charlottesville and in a couple other areas of that matter didn't do anything. They just stood on the sidelines. They never actively engaged with those people that were marching. I have to say that in Vancouver, that was different because they didn't wait for punches to be thrown. I think it was five people that were actually taken away. And from all the reports that we got and that some of our peace bearers saw, it was done well before anything got out of hand. So, and we did try to reach out to people that maybe, you know, did you feel violated? You know, is there something that we don't know that we're not understanding? And they're like, no, it was fine. So that was, you know, a little bit of credit there. But it's interesting if you really think, well, but how many people actually had that positive experience with police, right? Are they always on that side, right? Are they always taking action as they should? I got threats the day of, as I'm trying to organize people, the small group as we, you know, went to City Hall, and I'm getting things like, I hope you get shot at your own rally. right? Like straight out threats. And especially as a public school educator, being told, you know, if this goes any further, you have to tell your admin, you have to tell your school district, like, you know. And that was really interesting. And the hate I got afterwards as well, kind of on Twitter and Facebook and private messages, things of that nature.
So speaking of social media and death threats and being a woman on the internet, always a good time. How do you think social media can be used to confront fascism and white supremacy? And why does it seem that the right seems to be better at using it and organizing on social media?
Lots of fascists deny that they're fascists. They don't all look like the Indiana Jones Nazi stormtrooper person, right? But I think that they've developed for 10 years or more the use of social media collectively. Like, they're not just us individuals tweeting and saying things. They're like organizing themselves into armies of real people and sock puppet people and bots and doing things collectively. You know, you can see sometimes there's a big pulse of activity that then shuts down at, you know, 5 o'clock or till 11 o'clock, and it starts to reveal the time zone where they're all organizing from. And the fact that they're organizing collectively as a movement, and the left and the middle is more or less individuals, and sometimes individuals that are networks of colleagues and common cause and allies, but not in the same way they are, where they really issue instruction manuals and targets, and, you know, they can say, well, we've doxed this person, we figure out their address, here's their picture, here's their kids, now go get them. And that message goes out to thousands of potential far-right activists, and they do that. You know, we don't have that kind of organization.
But I'm wondering if it's also possible that the people who are really attracted to this movement and who you see, and we see it with the Proud Boys and we've seen it with some of the other organizations, we're talking about young males, and, you know, that's a pretty narrow group, and it's very high energy and it can be very focused. The anti-fascist movement and the people who are against racism and who are against these very threatening types of movements in society are kind of all over the map. Are they not? I mean, they're in multiple communities and they're different age groups, and it's very hard to get that kind of cohesion.
But at the same time, anti-fascist, anti-racist, whatever, you know, however you choose to define yourself, we have to fight 10 fires all the time. Mm-hmm. And really, the other side just has to fight one. So how can you, right? You're trying to help all these different types of people, and literally even just coming here today, being told by several different people, oh, Annie, don't be too political. Right? Like, so, wait a minute.
This is a politics show.
Whoops.
be boring.
So, it's rather interesting to see even how one's own activity can be curtailed, you know, because, oh, no, but take care of yourself, mm-hmm. right? Don't do too much, right? Don't go too far.
Yeah, our own democratic impulses are sometimes a disadvantage to us. Like, have you ever been at a really, like, a left sort of coalition meeting and you spend the first hour and a half debating the rules of how the meeting's going to run and how you vote and stuff? They don't have that problem on the far right. They say, you're going to do it this way. And everyone's like, yes, sir. Yes, we love the strong leader, you know? Like, what Annie says is they've got all these advantages baked in all around them, right? They've got, the history of colonialism, capitalism, white supremacy. All these things are, like, sort of the common sense wallpaper of the world around us that they just get to rely on. So they've got that whole current kind of going their way, which is probably why they're so earnestly telling us all the time that politically correct snowflake cultural Marxists are actually running the economy and the, you know, the politics and the world and everything like that, which is just a deflection from the truth of it. You know, it's like you were saying, they always have, like, you know, like, imagine Peter Mansbridge or something like that. He's concluding a section on the residential schools. He goes, a dark chapter in Canadian history. And it's, you know, well, that's just ended in the mid-90s. And so that's not just a dark chapter. That's a whole fucking book, right? And then you add all the other chapters we've illuminated. Then you have this. So there's this little half-like thing at the end that's not quite as dark chapter. So, you know, it's part of me, I'm just like, this great white North shithole of empire loyalists. God damn. But on the other hand, every moment there's resistance. Every of all those Peter Mansbridge's dark chapters of history, there's always, always, always resistance. And sometimes when it doesn't look like it's there, we just haven't figured it out. Or we don't know, or we're not listening to the right voices. And that's the real history that we have to recover. And it's like recovering that history and making those links and remembering that that's the tradition that we're rooted in, the history of resistance to these terrible things. And that maybe is the moment of optimism that I've been searching for and denying everybody half of the night.
So that's our show for this week. I'm Hadia Rodrigue. Follow me at D Rodrigue on Twitter. That's RODERIQUE.
And I'm Sandy Garasino. You can read me at National Observer and follow me on Twitter at Garasino.
Thank you to Annie and Garth for joining us. And thank you to the folks at Organize BC for bringing us to Vancouver and making this show possible. You can give like a woo! You can follow us on Twitter at Canada Land Commons. That's Canada Land CMNS. Check out our website at canadalandshow.com/commons. And you can email us, and we do respond, at commons@canadalandshow.com. Our Patreon page is patreon.com/canadaland. This episode is produced by Abby Madon. Our music is produced by Nathan Burley. And if you like what we do, please support us. We did it! Yeah!
This episode of Commons is brought to you in part by Canardian. What is Canardian, you ask? Well, it is a podcast that's gossiping about Canadian hometowns. Every episode, podcast producer and writer Katie Lauer is joined by various Canadian podcasting personalities to unravel the juicy stories about their hometowns from trusted sources like eyewitness testimony, community Facebook groups, subreddits, and Wikipedia. Nothing I say is fact-checked, but it is pretty dang entertaining. And you know who is a guest on this season of Canardian? Well, none other than yours truly. So if you are interested in the very important distinctions between Surrey and North Delta, if you want to learn whether or not I could outrun the Delta PD, well, this is the podcast for you. Listen and subscribe to Canardian from Pod the North right now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. This episode is brought to you in part by the Douglas Mattress. Now, I've said it before and I'll say it again. One of the best, and I mean the best things you can do for yourself is to get a good quality mattress. The time is now, people. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress protector, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.